second case this morning, Mahaffey v. Ramos. Mr. Friedman.
The merits issue before this court, before the federal courts, is and has always been whether the state's use of parental challenges to exclude all the blacks from the jury violated the petitioner's rights under Batson v. Kentucky. Before the merits is a question before this court whether the petitioner's motion to reinstate this Batson claim effectively instituted a timely application for habeas relief pursuant to Section 2254 in the district court. Whether a motion to reinstate a previous claim after a conditional writ has been granted is the best or the proper way to bring a federal claim following its relitigation in the state court after the last Coulter opinion is a red herring. And we're not conceding that it was inappropriate. But the motion to reinstate here was effectively a timely habeas petition, because the substance of the pleading should govern, not the title of the pleadings itself. For example, federal courts on numerous occasions have determined in substance that a filed document labeled as a habeas petition is a 1983 claim, vice versa. The court should look to the substance of the document, not the form. In this case, the motion satisfied the requirements of Rule 2C for habeas corpus cases. There were specific grounds pled, relief, and the facts. The facts related back to the previous claim that was filed. The motion requested that the court reinstate the proceedings of the Batson claim and grant the petition on that claim pursuant to 2254. The motion indicated petitioner continues to maintain that the state engaged in purposeful discrimination, which is a substantive equal protection claim. This was not a McFarland petition. McFarland petition simply asked for appointment of counsel in a death penalty case. This was not done here. Even if the pleadings are defective, we submit equitable tolling should apply. At the time of the motion of reinstatement was filed, and during the whole statute of limitation period, the only opinions were in the Seventh Circuit and the District Court in the whole country to determine whether a motion to reinstate was a proper vehicle to institute a federal habeas proceeding.
But what period are you asking be tolled?
I'm asking for the tolling to occur once the motion to reinstate was filed.
But then the Coulter panel opinion came out within, four or five or six months of that.
After the statute had already gone.
Right. But then the case just sat for a long period of time after that until the brief got filed.
But that's correct. It was also a non-death penalty habeas. And traditionally, judges determine whether that document should be dismissed or a return be filed. And nothing happened, and ultimately the petitioner filed the brief.
At best, the tolling period that you would get would be from when you filed the motion to reinstate until the Coulter panel opinion came out. Are you asking that the entire period until you filed the brief is...
Yeah, and it's not clear even in the Coulter opinion itself.
Well, it's pretty clear from the Coulter panel opinion that a motion to reinstate was not the appropriate vehicle.
It was not
a
perfect vehicle.
It's a brand new habeas issue. It's a new determination by the state court that there was no Batson violation after a full Batson hearing. So what would be called for there would be a new habeas.
But the question is, it's not even clear the Coulter opinion actually said that. They said that the motion to reinstate didn't relate back to avoid the APA review. They never determined whether that document could ultimately trigger the jurisdiction of the court. They never went that far. So there's enough ambiguousness here that should tip in favor of the petitioner. But nevertheless, we say what was filed was enough. And in fact, this is such a unique proceeding because most of the circuits, in fact, all the circuits other than this circuit, has indicated that it goes back to the state court. All the other circuits have the hearing in federal court, and ultimately you just file a notice of appeal. You don't have this complicated procedure. As to the merits, we submit that the Illinois Court of Appeals decision is an unreasonable application in light of the evidence presented to the court. There was no consideration of the totality of the circumstances as required by Batson and Millerell. The totality of circumstances is the lens that this court should use in evaluating the striking of prospective black jurors. Batson and Millerell make clear that all relevant circumstances should be used to determine whether it was purposeful discrimination, to determine whether the state's post-hack rationalizations, evaluating those post-hack rationalizations. The Illinois Appellate Court didn't tend to that. This case was tried before Batson. Before Batson, the state was largely immune from constitutional scrutiny, and it was an open secret, as the late Justice Seymour said. They would literally knock them all off, and that's what happened here. And this was done here. There were 77 individuals that was considered for service. 20 were black, 13 were challenged for cause, and 7 were removed. The state removed all the blacks. Justice Souter said in Millerell that happenstance is unlikely to produce this disparity. Even Millerell had one black on the jury. Even Coulter, a close case, might have won with day and overview versus the Apper standard, had 3 blacks on the jury. Even the method of excluding the blacks show an indication of discrimination. It was done in panels of 4. They immediately, when a black showed up in the panel of 4, the state knocked the black off. They didn't even wait for a backstrike. They didn't even give the defendants a chance to evaluate the blacks. In fact, but they did allow at least one to go on the panel of 4, which they ultimately knocked out on a backstrike. This case was also extremely racially sensitive. It was 2 blacks from the Unit City. The Presterio came and were convicted of a horrible, brutal crime. Even the closing argument has some theme of us versus them. I mean, talking about you are the community, show justice against them. So it's through that lens that you have to evaluate the justifications of excluding, ultimately, the blacks on the case. When you compare them with the whites that were on the jury, it's a difference that makes no difference at all. I point out the 2 major ones, Nathaniel Howard. They said that the reason was that he suffered a hardship, he was taking medication even though he had his prescription, and that he had helped his mother-in-law, but he wasn't the primary caretaker. His wife wasn't even worked during the day. And then you compare it to a white who said he took care of his parents who lived with him, he had nobody else to take care of him, and there's no difference here. And it's even more interesting. The defendants tried to say, Davis said, I'm going to have trouble concentrating. If there's a snowstorm, it's the winter, and it was tried in January, and the defense said we should excuse him for cause. And the state said, no, there's not a basis here. And the judge said, well, it'll be a hardship, but not that much of a hardship. And he shows up on the jury. Difference that makes no difference. Finally, I want to talk about Catherine Taylor. There's another one because she answered questions on her. But all those questions were asked in a leading form. When she was asked factual questions, she answered the judge. There was nothing in the record to indicate she didn't understand what you was talking about, that she was incoherent. They also used the basis that she didn't subscribe to magazines. There are many whites that didn't subscribe to magazines. They also said that she had trouble understanding could you give police officers testimony credit like any other witness? And she said, I guess so. But if you look at the record, and they're all cited in the brief, plenty of whites responded in the same fashion. And finally, the state doesn't even defend the last reason they gave, was that she thought under certain circumstances that the death penalty should be automatic. Well, that's favorable to the state. And other whites had said that, and they weren't objected. But when you look at a reason that can't even be defended here, that calls into question any of the other challenges that they made to show that it's pretext. It's not for me to boast the state's case. The state has a triable case, more than a triable case. In fact, they retried Reginald Mahaffey. Just they had a root and climb. He was tried with Reginald Mahaffey, and he was found guilty. They have the case, and they can prove the case now. The real question is whether racism should end. And it would be a good message to say no more, to exclude all blacks from the jury, particularly in an area where there's a lot of them in the Chicago region. And we asked this court to be remanded to the district court to rule on the merits or alternatively to rule here. The court's have any questions? So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. O'Connell?
May it please the court, Assistant Attorney General Erin O'Connell on behalf of the respondent warden. The court should affirm the judgment of the district court for two reasons. First, the petition that petitioner ultimately filed was untimely. Second, it lacks any merit. I'd like to address each of these in turn. The timeliness issue has three components. The first one is, did petitioner need to file a brand new petition? The answer to that is clearly yes. Coulter made that absolutely clear. That's the only sensible answer to the question because this court granted a writ of habeas corpus. The effect of a writ of habeas corpus must be to void the original state judgment of conviction. Therefore, when this case returned to the state court for further proceedings, it created a new judgment. That judgment needs to be reviewed in this case through a brand new habeas petition. The second issue with respect to timeliness is what qualified in this case as a substantive habeas petition. Petitioner has argued strenuously that his motion to reinstate, which is the only document that he filed within the time limit, should suffice for this purpose. However, the defects in this motion are clear because a petition for habeas corpus has to give the district court some basis for granting habeas corpus relief. This motion for reinstatement did not even ask the court to grant habeas corpus.
Well, didn't it have a copy of the Illinois Appellate Court decision attached to it that affirmed the conviction after the full Batson hearing?
It did, Your Honor.
And didn't it have language from which you could infer that the petitioner here was seeking additional Batson relief, that it was contending that the Batson determination by the Illinois court was incorrect?
There's no dispute that the parties were aware that he intended to bring a Batson claim and to challenge the new state judgment. However, it was his burden to submit a document that provided enough facts and argument to allow the district court to grant habeas relief. The motion is defective on that score. Now, the motion, once it was granted, left nothing pending on the district court's docket. Petitioner has stated, well, I didn't actually need to file anything additional. Now it was the district court's, the ball was in the district court's court. The court was required under Rule 4 of the Rules of Governing Habeas Corpus Petitions to review the merits of the pleading and determine if it was facially sufficient. It's clear, though, that the motion to reinstate did not trigger the district court's obligation under Rule 4. Everybody understood that to be the case. The state understood that to be the case. The district court did. Nothing happened here for, you know, over a year until petitioner finally filed his substantive memorandum.
I'm curious about that, too, because the motion to reinstate requested reinstatement, appointment of counsel, and the setting of a schedule, some sort of briefing schedule.
Yes.
And the order, I guess it's a minute order, granting the motion just said granted, but did none of those other things.
Correct. The district court's order is a little bit unclear. Because the court said, I'm granting the motion to reinstate, it could be inferred that the court was simply allowing the case to be docketed for further proceedings. Certainly there could have been more language in the district court's order as to how it was disposing of the additional requests, and it is a little bit unclear in that score. However, the district court made no indication that the case would proceed without further action by the petitioner. Again, the petitioner himself must have realized this because ultimately he did file his memorandum. The case then proceeded as any habeas case would. The state became involved. The district court resumed proceedings. This was when the habeas case really started, and this was clearly untimely, well over a year late.
How much time expired between the issuance of the Coulter panel opinion in April and the ultimate filing of the brief?
309 days. And then the issue is, did the district court abuse its discretion in denying equitable tolling? Petitioner cannot possibly demonstrate that he is entitled to 10 months of equitable tolling after the Coulter opinion came out. Even if there were some basis before that opinion, which there's not, because still petitioner was not diligent in filing his petition, he still had 95 days after he filed his motion to reinstate to file a substantive petition. He didn't, and nothing certainly was impeding him from doing so. He wasn't entitled to equitable tolling, but certainly he was not entitled to any equitable tolling after Coulter came out. Coulter made absolutely clear that this is a new proceeding. This is a challenge to a new state judgment. It requires a new habeas petition. Petitioner did nothing. On the second issue is whether petitioner's Batson claim has merit. Clearly the answer to that is also no. At this point, the deferential standards of Section 2254D apply. The court may only grant habeas relief on this Batson claim if the state court was objectively unreasonable in its resolution of the claim. Now, because we're reviewing a third stage finding following all of the prosecutor's race-neutral explanations, we're reviewing the credibility determinations of the state courts. There's one question at the third stage. Do we believe the prosecutor? Did the reasons that he gave, are they plausible? Are they pretextual? The trial court observed the prosecutor give these explanations. He determined that the prosecutor's explanations were credible. The state appellate court said the prosecutor's explanations are supported by the record. Each of them is unique to the juror that was excused. It's a legitimate basis. It's related to the purpose of the case. Therefore, we can't reverse the trial court's credibility determination. Now, this court even needs to accord even greater deference to the trial court's determination that the prosecutor was credible when he gave his testimony regarding his reasons. One issue that petitioner raised in his reply brief is a contention that the prosecutor's explanations should be viewed with suspicion because they were not given earlier in the proceedings. This is false, and Batson makes clear that the prosecutor has no obligation to reveal his reasons for striking a juror until a court makes a determination that the petitioner has shown a prima facie case of discrimination. In this case, there was no prima facie case. At the hearing, the prosecutor indicated that there were some reasons that might be apparent on the record, and there were some reasons that were not clear from the record. The prosecutor stated, I'm not giving any reasons that are not apparent from the record at this point. This is all in Supplemental Record, Volume 7, page 26. He says, yes, there's more. I'm not giving it. after that happened and there was no prima facie case, and then it proceeded through the district court, petitioner again says, well, when it came to the district court, the state should have proffered its reasons then. However, the situation was identical. There still was no prima facie case. The only reasons that the state could rely on were those apparent from the record. At this, after the court granted habeas corpus and required the state to do a new hearing, that was when the prosecutor was finally required to give his reasons for exercising the strikes. This is where he gave reasons that are not clear from simply looking at the record. The first one is Catherine Taylor. Now, there were reasons, there were answers she gave to certain questions that were equivocal, apparent from the record. There was a more global feeling of the prosecutor that, based on her demeanor and her very short answers to the court's questions, that she was not very communicative, that she would not participate well in deliberations. At the second stage, the prosecutor said, based on my experience, my extensive trial experience, I believe that a juror who does not have good communication skills, as evidenced by numerous factors in this case, including her failure to subscribe to periodicals and her short responses, I don't believe that she would make a good juror. Perfectly legitimate reason to exercise a strike, plausible. The trial court credited it, and this court cannot find that to be unreasonable. Petitioner, in his reply brief, also has suggested that the state has somehow conceded that certain reasons are pretextual or insufficient. Again, these all relate to the reasons that were on the face of the record. The prosecutor picked out questions that the jurors gave equivocal answers to, which created, part of the whole picture of who the juror was and whether they were suitable. In Appley's brief, we focused on the real reasons that the prosecutor gave that were not clear from the face of the record. Of course, the prosecutor did not lie when he said that these other answers to questions played a role in exercising his strike. But when he gave his full reasons, he gave very strong reasons that were, again, not clear from the face of the record based on demeanor or other considerations. And therefore, there's simply no basis, again, for finding that these previous reasons were pretextual, so we can't believe the subsequent ones. If the court has no further questions on either issue, we would ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you. How much time does Mr. Friedman have? You have 4 minutes, Mr. Friedman.
Just briefly. First of all, we submit it's a three-page document, the motion to reinstate. You can obviously review it. We requested relief for that. The rules doesn't require argument. In fact, they discourage, argument. That should be filed ultimately in the traverse that's filed. So we submit that the document is adequate. As to whether, although the major point is not equitable tolling, we believe the document was filed was adequate. It's not the best, perhaps not the best way, but we're talking about tolling statute of limitations. We're talking about, people shouldn't be filing suits one day before the statute, but they do. It tolls the statute, and we submit that the motion to reinstate tolls the statute here. And even the Coulter opinion doesn't talk about retroactivity. The motion for reinstatement was filed. It didn't say whether in this case, once the court granted the motion to reinstate, that motion is no longer reinstated. It's like basic jurisdiction. Once jurisdiction is created, the jurisdiction is not subsequently lost. And we submit that Judge Zagel created jurisdiction by granting the motion to reinstate. He didn't say motion denied. That's an inadequate. It was adequate at the time based on the Coulter opinion. As to deference, we can say obviously APRA applies here and deference applies, but deference doesn't mean no review at all. And that the trial court here made really, he just denied relief. The order is attached in the opinion. He says denied. He says that there's no basis for discrimination. He didn't go and say, I believe this, I believe that, I find this, I find that. And so ultimately, and then the appellate court reviews it, and they don't get an opportunity to review anything. So this court can basically review this, just like the appellate court reviewed it, because there's no actual facts or findings in the sense of credibility other than the simple denial. And that is important. And you have, you know, the difference between one reason or not really depends on the lens that you look at it. If there were multiple blacks on the jury, the reasons wouldn't appear as outrageous as the arguments as I'm pressing now. But the fact that they excluded all the blacks, they never gave the defendants an opportunity to do that. You have to consider this, the history that the case was brought before it, and you ultimately have to consider the closing argument. And the harm is that they have to retry the case. This case will not go away. And with that, unless this court has any questions, I urge first to find that the motion to restate created jurisdiction. I recommend that it goes back so Judge Zagel can add his wisdom to this case, or alternatively, we rule on the merits.
Mr. Friedman, you took this case by appointment, didn't you?
Yes, I was appointed in the district court.
You have the appreciation of the court for a fine representation of your client. Thank you.
Thank you. Case